Hello, it's June 30th, 2020, and this is our morning Bible study. Well, today we are going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 10. 2 Samuel chapter 10. And for those who may not be, you know, incredibly familiar with 2 Samuel and the history of the kings, 2 Samuel chapter 10 seems kind of like, you know, just a story, doesn't really bear a whole lot of significance, and yet this is the, you know, the beginning of a very dramatic series of events that are going to have drastic and dramatic consequences for the House of David. It's kind of like, you know, a Rube Goldberg machine. Do you remember the, you know, the old Rube Goldberg machines where one event leads to a whole series of needlessly complicated other events, and yet somehow there's a causal chain that links the first event to, you know, an alarm clock going off or, you know, something. And that's the Rube Goldberg machine. It's a needlessly complicated machine that yields an end result. Well, it's in that way, this is kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine. You have a series of events that really aren't connected, and yet they are connected. There's a causal chain between these events. And when we look at this causal chain, we see that there's a reason why God includes this story, why this is included in the divine record. And that's because God, of course, and the human authors were able to see a causal chain. They were able to see a connection that needed to be made between the events in chapter 10 and what happens really throughout the rest of the history of the kings. I mean, this is going to have long-range consequences. I mean, consequences that are still felt to this day. I mean, that what happens here has consequences that last until this day. Okay, and that's one of the things. The further back you go in history, generally the broader their impact can be. Well, anyways, so go ahead and pause your audio right now, and when you unpause it, text. Okay, so we are in chapter 10, like we said, and let's look at what happens. Okay, I'm gonna read through the text with you. We're gonna have a commentary style. Remember, if you want to do your 5 W's, that's something. Go ahead and pause your audio now and do your 5 W's. You can do a plot chart on your own. You can do those things. But right now, we're going to just move through the text as a commentary sermon type style. Okay, so it says later, of course, later is after David had brought Mephibosheth to his throne, and he says, later the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanun succeeded him. Now, the Ammonites are cousins to the Israelites. So, Ammi was a child, Ammi or Ammon, I don't remember which, one of the two, and Moab were the children of Lot by his daughters, okay? So, the Moabites and the Ammonites are actually related to the Israelites. They're just as, well, yeah, they're about as related to the Israelites as the Ishmaelites, who would be the modern day Arabs. They're not quite as closely related as the Edomites, but they're kind of in that thing. They're all kind of cousins to each other, and they're all aware of these relationships. Well, the king of the Ammonites died, and his son Hanun succeeded him. And David said, I will express loyalty to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father was loyal to me. Okay, so David, in good faith, says that he wants to, after the king dies, he wants to show kindness because Nahash had shown kindness to him. Now, Nahash is a name that we've seen before. It seems like Nahash is probably, either a name that follows through the royal line of the Ammonites, or Nahash is a royal title. I'm not really sure which. But if it's related to the Hebrew idea of Nahash, maybe it means bronze, or it could mean beautiful, or it could mean a snake. So there's some interesting directions we could go with that name. But so Nahash was kind to David. I don't know that we know how Nahash was kind to David, but David says that he was. And so David sends his servants with a message expressing sympathy over Hanun's father's death, that is, over the death of Nahash, the king of the Ammonites. And when David's servants entered the land of the Ammonites, the Ammonite officials said to their lord Hanun, do you really think David is trying to honor your father by sending these messengers to express his sympathy? No, David has sent his servants to you to get information about the city, to spy on it so we can overthrow it. Okay, so everybody's aware that David and that Israel is an expanding power. The Ammonite officials, they smell a rat. And they believe that David is using this as an opportunity to spy out the city, and that he doesn't really care about Nahash. He doesn't really care about showing sympathy to Hanun. They say, listen, This is just the worst. You know, he's using your father's death as a pretext to come and spy out the city so that he can conquer it. This is bad. So what does Hanan do? Now, let's say, for instance, okay, you have a large expansionary power that you're sort of afraid of, okay? There's, you know, you're the Ammonites. You can see Israel is large, Israel is growing, they're much bigger than you, but they're more powerful, they're on the move, they're on the rise, and you believe, rightly or wrongly, you believe that they've sent messengers to spy out your land. Well, you know what? That's called diplomacy. Every diplomat is a spy, okay? I mean, in the ancient world and in the modern world, I can't speak for today, but, you know, you look throughout history, every diplomat is a spy, and everybody knows that, okay? Everybody knows that. That was a well-known fact. If you have a diplomat, the diplomat's a spy. All right, that was just, and they're working, they're bribing your officials, they're working for the best interests of their nation, okay? So do a little bit of a study of a history of diplomacy, and you will see every diplomat is a spy, every diplomat is involved in bribes, every ambassador is involved in some kind of untoward or corrupt behavior, because that's what they do. They're trying to strengthen the position of their own nation, even if it's at the cost of every other nation, okay? So there are protocols and policies for dealing with this. Okay, what do you do? You just accept it. You try to hide things out from them. You don't let them see everything. You let them see what you want them to see. You know, you give them the runaround. You give them the rigmarole. You send them on their way. Okay, that's history. That's policy. Diplomats have always been, you know, untouchable. They're inviolable. You cannot touch an ambassador, whether they are really, really guilty of really horrible things. Sorry, that's the game. You might not like it, you might not want to play it, but that's the game. If you want to have diplomats in their country, they need to have diplomats in your country, and they're probably spies, just like your diplomats are spies, okay? That's just the way it works, all right? And in fact, it's really interesting if you do a study of the Cold War. It was well known. I mean, it was just well known that the embassies between the United States and their proxies and the Soviet Union and their proxies, everybody knew that the diplomats had a large number of spies there. And, you know, it was kind of a joke, and it was kind of a game, you know, and it's if you can actually prove that they do something, then you revoke their credentials and you say, hey, you got to take that guy back, right? Like, he got caught. We know you're all spies, but this guy got caught. We can prove it. So take him back, send a new spy, you know, and it was a game. I mean, but it was a game with very serious consequences. So throughout history, there has been this understanding that ambassadors are inviolable. You cannot touch them, and everybody knows the game. Except Hanan, apparently. So Hanan, remember, David is a large expansionary power. Israel is. And Hanan is afraid of Israel. So what does he do? What would you try to do? Would you try to, you know, placate a large expansionary power, or would you try to insult them? Let's think. Let's put our thinking caps on. What does Hanan do? Well, Hanan seized David's servants and shaved off half of each one's beard. They cut off the lower part of their robes so that their buttocks were exposed and sent them away. Okay, well, if their buttocks were exposed, also were their front parts were, but this is just the Bible being, you know, kind of, the Bible is kind of euphemizing things and you know, saying things so that they're, you know, it's a little bit nicer. They're churching it up a little bit. And so basically, they shave off half of their beards, and then they sent them on their way. So, you know, they've got half of their face is exposed to the sun, they don't have their beards, and they look like dorks, and then they get their stuff cut off in the middle of their, unto their buttocks, and so, you know, they're walking around basically with just a shirt, and their butt and their genitals are exposed, and they're sent away. They're sent away from the city, and so messengers tell David what happened. So this is, they didn't kill them. But it was probably, in the world of diplomacy, that's just as bad, maybe even worse than killing somebody, because you didn't just kill them as a threat. You disgraced them and humiliated them and shamed them publicly. And so messengers told David what had happened, and so he summoned them, for the men were thoroughly humiliated. The king said, "Stay in Jericho until your beards have grown again, and then you may come back." Okay, so first of all, I think that what this text teaches us, if we want a theological point to draw from this text, is that all men should not be seen in public until they grow a thoroughly rich and luscious beard. I think that's the probably the only conclusion we can draw from this text. So just know that right away. Well, I guess there are other things we can draw from this text. Other things we can draw from this text are that David is concerned about his men, but he's pretty angry now. He's pretty mad because the Ammonites realized that David was disgusted, and they sent and hired 20,000 foot soldiers from Aram Beth Rehob and Aram Zobah, in addition to 1,000 men from the king of Maacah and 12,000 from Ishtob. Okay? And Ishtob sounds like, or Ishtob sounds like good man. So, or it could be the men of Tob, or it could be, maybe it was a guy who was called like good man, you know, like Saul Goodman, Saul Goodman, you know? They some of the early versions, the Net Bible gives this note. Some of the early versions say that they understand this name to be Ishtob, as the name of the place. It's possible that Ish is didographic and that we should read simply Tob. An earlier a reading adopted by a number of recent English versions do that. They say because it would be like 12,000 Ish, Ma'ishtob. So it would be, you know, men from good men, you know, or good man. So, you know, it's hard to say what's going on, but anyways, the Net Bible says, yeah, maybe it's not didography, maybe that was actually the name of the place, or, you know, maybe there's just a good guy out there just giving out foot soldiers, just the good man out there. He's like, I got 12,000, who wants them? And you know, the Ammonites take them. So the Ammonites have hired 33,000 foot soldiers. That's a large number of men. So it's a large number of men for them to have drawn into their sphere of influence, because obviously they're afraid of David now. They realize that what they did was probably not the best choice. And they're Arameans. So they've got Ammonites and Arameans. And remember, who are the Arameans? The Arameans are people from Aram. Yeah, I know. It's amazing. That's amazing that we're able to know things like that. But, you know, the Arameans, they are the people from Damascus. Okay, Aram was Damascus. It's Syria. And so they get these people from the area around Syria, which is to the north of Israel. And so they're getting a bunch of men from the surrounding areas. And they, you know, they want to be able to defend themselves. So when David heard the news, he sent Joab and the entire army to meet them. Now, we're not told how big the army is. And we're not really told how big the opposing army is, because of course you have the Ammonites' own soldiers on top of the 33,000 that they hired out. And so the Ammonites marched out and were deployed for battle at the entrance of the city gate, while the men from Aram Zobah, Rehob, Ishtob, and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Okay, so basically, the Ammonites say, you know, okay, we're going to be right at the entrance of the city gate. The people who live here in the city, we're going to defend the city gate, and everybody else is going to kind of support the wings, which is a good decision, because really, the city is the most important part of this battle. So if you let the city be taken, it's all over. It's all over. And so you don't put your mercenaries in front of the most important thing, because mercenaries, believe it or not, mercenaries have a tendency to change sides. I know, weird that people who will fight and kill and murder people for money will switch sides for more money. I know, it's a shocker. But, you know, you don't always trust mercenaries with the most important position. So, you know, they're there and they're doing their thing. They're getting ready to fight. Now, Joab saw that the battle would be fought on two fronts, so he chose some of Israel's best men and deployed them against the Arameans. He put his brother Abishai in charge of the rest of the army, and they were deployed against the Ammonites. Okay, so basically, here's what happens. And this is going to sound really, really strange, but Joab chooses a smaller force, but a better force. So Joab takes the cream of the army, which is smaller, a more select group of men, but it's smaller, so that he can go and fight the Arameans. Who are the Arameans? Well, the Arameans are basically that whole contingent of that 33,000 men who are the hired mercenary foot soldiers. He put his brother Abishai in charge of the rest of the army, and that would probably, you know, pretty well be understood as the majority of the army, who are going to fight against the city gates. Now, it would only make sense that the Ammonites are a much bigger force than the Arameans whom they've hired out. You know, the Arameans are augmenting their force. They're not providing the majority of their force. Because, I mean, at this point, it's all hands on deck. I mean, anybody that can wield a sword is out there. Anybody that can hold a spear is out there. And so Joab says, well, I'm going to take part of the army. I'm going to take the cream of the army, but a smaller force. And my brother, Abishai, I want you to take the larger force, and I want you to try to drive into the city gates. Okay, so this is their plan. And he says, Joab said, if the Arameans start to overpower me, you come to my rescue. If the Ammonites start to overpower you, I will come to your rescue. Be strong. Let's fight bravely for the sake of our people and the cities of our God. The Lord will do what he decides is best. Okay, remember how I told you that Joab is kind of a riddle wrapped in an enigma inside, you know, a perplexion? I could keep going with that, but I'm not going to. So Joab does this, and Joab, it really seems like a great commander. He shows intelligence, he shows courage, he shows a willingness to rest in the hands of God. And that's Joab is, it, that's why I said, this, when you look at David and Joab in parallel, it is really hard to understand sometimes who the good guy is and who the bad guy is. But as we look at their lives towards the end of their life, when we have the declaration from God, it seems that Joab is a bad man who does good things, and David is a good man who does bad things. Now, that can be really hard to separate sometimes. But David and Joab are used as foils against each other. We're seeing Joab at his best and worst. We see David at his best and worst. Okay? And some people have rebuked me on that. They've said, no, Joab is a real believer, and we'll see Joab in heaven. Well, I mean, I hope so. I don't want anyone to perish, you know? But Joab is out there, and he's going to fight for his men. And they say, let's trust in Yahweh. That's pretty good advice. And so Joab and his men marched out to do battle with the Arameans, and they fled before him. Why? Because they're mercenaries. They've already gotten their money. They don't want to lose their lives. Because you know what you can't do with money when you're dead? You can't spend it. You don't get to spend your money on wine, women, and song when you're dead. So you know what you do? You take your money and you run. Okay, so we kind of forget that in the ancient world, unless there were battles of extermination, most battles actually had relatively low casualty rates, because generally the armies were pretty small, and people were not fighting to the bitter, ugly end all the time. People were taken into slavery, people surrendered, people ran away. You know, the casualties generally tended to be really low, the rates of casualties. And so, you know, is them running away surprising? No, it's not. Because if you've been paid to go fight for this nation, and you're fighting against, you know, maybe a much better force, and you've already gotten your money, and you can see that this is a losing battle, why stick around? I mean, I'm not saying that I'm defending the mercenaries. I'm just saying, like, who sticks around for that? Who you know, if you're, especially if you're the Arameans, you know, we better get home, because, you know, David might kind of be mad that we fought against him, so maybe we need to get home and defend our own cities. If he's going to send the whole army, we may be in bigger trouble than we realized. And so they flee, and when the Ammonites saw that the Arameans fled, they fled before Joab's brother, his brother Abishai, and went into the city. Joab withdrew from fighting the Ammonites and returned to Jerusalem. Okay, so just pause really quick here. Joab and his men go out. They drive the Arameans away. And as soon as the Ammonites see the Arameans flee, they just rush back into the city. They run back into the city. They're like, we're not even going to risk battle, because that would be, you know, that would be casting it all on one battle. And they said they would rather be besieged than try to fight it out. And so Joab goes back, and he returns to Jerusalem. When the Arameans realized they had been defeated by Israel, that is, the mercenaries, they consolidated their forces. Then Hadadezer sent for Arameans from beyond the Euphrates River, and they came to Helam. Shobach, the general in command of Hadadezer's army, led them. When David was informed, He gathered all Israel, crossed the Jordan River, and came to Helam. The Arameans deployed their forces against David and fought with him. The Arameans fled before Israel. David killed 700 Aramean charioteers and 40,000 foot soldiers. He also struck down Shobach, the general in command of the army who died there. When all the kings who were subject to Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subjects of Israel. The Arameans were no longer willing to help the Ammonites. Okay, so what's happened? Let's take a quick pause, a quick review here of what's happening in this story. So David has his soldiers, and they go to fight against the Ammonites because the Ammonites have committed an atrocity. Really, they've committed an atrocity against ambassadors, and that warrants war. I mean, that means war. And so David goes out to fight them. Well, the Ammonites hire Arameans. They hire these mercenaries from Aram, which is modern-day Syria. They hire these Syrian mercenaries. The Syrian mercenaries, like, the battle just begins, and they're like, nope, not sticking around for this. They rush home because they're afraid that David is going to then muster his army and go and conquer the Arameans after they conquer the Ammonites. Well, then the Arameans, in even more stupidity, they don't sue for peace. They don't try to make peace. They gather their army so that they can go and fight against Israel, which is really dumb, by the way. It's just dumb. And so David gathers all of his army, and David himself goes. He's not just sending Joab and Abishai at this point. He's actually going out himself. David's saying, I'm going to go and personally command this army, and we're going to deal with this. So the Arameans deployed their forces, and David fought with them. The Arameans fled before Israel. David killed. Now, this is where we see this was a battle that must have involved significant numbers of forces, because like I said, normally the casualty rates in these ancient battles were relatively low, at least in the actual battlefield deaths. Now, you had a lot of deaths due to sickness and in prolonged injuries because of poor medical treatment. But, you know, it was people normally fled. They didn't stick around to die. OK, so this was a significantly large battle. The Arameans fled before Israel. David killed 700 Aramean charioteers and 40,000 foot soldiers. This was a massive battle. This was a massive battle. I mean, this was a battle that in the ancient world, this was a big one. This is two nations fighting in literally mortal combat. This is two nations fighting for the future of the survival of their nations. Okay? Syria is, Damascus, Aram, is a significant player in the ancient world at this time. They are a power. They have kings that are subject to them. They are a powerful force. And they see this as their opportunity to stop the expansion of Israel. They see Israel as a nation that's going to continue to grow and eventually will swallow them up. And so they say, we need to nip this in the bud. We need to go and we need to subjugate Israel. Well, so they go out and they try to do it and they lose. So this was gambling it all on one flip of the dice, one roll of the dice. Literally, I mean, this was literally gambling everything on one roll of the dice. This is one decisive battle to determine the whole thing, and everybody knew it. That's why the death rate was so high. That's why so many people died in this battle, because this was everything. This Aram is like, this is for our nation's future. And what happens? Well, they lost. And the kings who were subject to Hadadezer, to the Arameans, they go and make peace with Israel. And they're like, hey, we'll be your subjects. Okay, that's cool. And then the Arameans were no longer willing to help the Ammonites. Okay, now we're going to pause here. Tomorrow we're going to pick up chapter 11. Why did I spend so much time in detail talking about this? Well, one, because it's fascinating. Two, it gives us a real insight into the ancient world and how ancient politics worked. But three, the events that happened here, we see David actively involved. We see David handing off authority and not going and being actively involved. We see David expanding in his power. This is all creating a tableau for us. It's all giving us a glimpse into David, who he is, a glimpse into Israel. And this is all going to be important in chapter 11 when we cover chapter 11 tomorrow. So I look forward to talking to you tomorrow as we look into as we continue, really, this story, because really this story is not done until, quite a while after this. I mean, this is really just, this is almost like the prologue, okay? Chapter 10 is the prologue of chapter 11 and 12 and then eventually this story is finished with the Ammonites in chapter 12. But then, of course, we have all of that that follows. I mean, this is really the beginning of the end for David. This is an incredibly important passage. So it's good to know that what we're in this long single narrative. It's easy to divide it up into little pericopes, but really we have just begun one long narrative that will stretch to really the end of David's life. So I hope you'll join us tomorrow as we continue to look at the end of David's life. So we saw David in his wilderness wanderings. Now we're going to see David in the end of his life. Anyways, thank you. God bless. Bye.